Shivani, you've shared that moving from a 12-year consulting career to launching your interior design business was transformative, and the biggest hurdle wasn't external, but your own mindset. What is the single most potent belief or fear you had to confront and dismantle within yourself to make that transition? And once that specific mindset barrier finally crumbled, what was the first tangible shift that you noticed in your reality?
I think my biggest fear was whether I would be successful. And my second fear that came up was, what will people say? Like, what do people think?
Successful. What do you define as successful?
I was literally just about to ask that. What is success to you?
Yeah. Well, I had to sort of unpack that, I think, when I was making the decision. It had to do with, I think, money mindset. So I left a pretty lucrative position. I was in senior management. I was on a trajectory to sort of, you know, if I wanted to keep going down that consulting path to make it to the, you know, the two most senior positions in that career path.
And what consulting?
What were you doing?
Yeah, so I was working in the Canberra-based consulting firm. I left after 7 years, but I was a senior manager there working in risk, governance and assurance. So that was providing services to the federal government. Yeah, so leading
very
team.
Very different.
Different. I had...
There's a real clear linear path from there.
I was going to say, it's like...
Super left brain.
It's like Ford personality.
Yeah,
and
it was so
government.
I think by the end of it, I realised that I was, you know, obviously I had the qualifications, the experience working in business and commerce, and that acumen, business acumen that I learned through, you know, running those firms as a senior manager. It was all meant to be. I was supposed to pick up those skills and I was supposed to go down that path, but that wasn't where I was supposed to be, like, in the long term. So, yeah, it definitely has shaped the type of business leader I am. Like, I'm very sort of driven by systems and process and making sure that those systems within my business are really streamlined.
So that's a very interior designer trait.
And you know what? And we're going to get to what you do because we kind of haven't really touched it, but you are an interior designer. But I'd love to know, growing up, like, did you have this creative design flair, or did you kind of feel like your trajectory was, well, you had to go to university and you had to do this and you had to do that? Like, was that part of something that was ingrained in you early and you kind of had this innate desire to do something creative? Was that always, has that always been there?
I think so. I think, like, as a child, though, I don't think I was probably encouraged to explore it as much as I guess I gave myself permission to, like, later on in life. So when I think back to when I was a child and, like, my best friend in year one, or I think it was year two, we used to sort of, like, you know, dream about what we'd grow up to be, and we both decided we wanted to be fashion designers, and that was, like, our brand. We used to draw, like, amazing, you know, dresses. That's probably one of my earliest memories of being creative. And I always loved art throughout, like, high school, music, and I wasn't an actual musician, but I was always inspired by music. And, you know, like, if I wanted
to... What type of music?
Oh, no. I've always loved R&B and hip hop, but I love, you know, I think when I was at uni, there was an elective that I wanted to do, which was African drumming, and I was like, wow. I was really worried what that would look like on my transcript, so because I was going for, you know, a job in these major firms, ooh, this is my creative side popping out.
Matt studied, he went to university.
Same question I'm going to ask.
Went to university, right?
Yes.
And my wife also went to university.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my wife was always a fantastic drawer as she was growing up, was quite creative, and very intelligent, ended up going down, you know, environmental science path, and she's now a landscape designer.
Yeah, and so she's gone back into what she's passionate about.
I guess, yeah, and I guess we talk about passion a lot, and you kind of, life kind of puts you in a place sometimes where you just find where you should be.
Yeah,
and
definitely.
I know for me, the building site was that.
Yes.
I don't know if it was that was how it was for you.
I think I didn't enjoy being a carpenter. I did a degree in science and nutrition before. I think where I'm at now is what I wanted.
Yeah.
I wanted to do something that kind of hadn't been done, is where Passive House come into it, but then do more and educate. And I think that I'm now probably at the stage of what the goal was. If I really start to pick it apart, I knew when I started a carpentry apprenticeship, that's not what I wanted to be. I knew when I became a builder, that's what I wanted to be, but not what I wanted to be. And then it was like, what's next?
Yeah, interesting, because I still love creating.
Yeah.
Like last weekend I made some gates out of reclaimed timber for my vegetable garden. And
that's super creative.
I was just like, I was in my element, in my zone. Five hours just went.
Yeah.
But now I can't be on site.
So this is the difference. But like, yeah, so you love still being involved in the tools. Like, I can't do it. Like, I just, it's not, I'm not good at it. And I realise I'm not good at it.
Yeah.
Where I think you probably still have the skill to do it.
Yeah, I love it.
See, so what did you study, uni?
So I studied commerce accounting. Accounting was my major.
Smart cookie.
I've actually probably evolved a lot through my teenage years and then into accounting. But where I started as a teenager trying to make that decision of what to do with, you know, when I grow up was
Because at 13, 14, 15, we are in the best mindset lifelong decision. So
you're about getting your first kiss, let alone your own.
When I was 15, I wanted to be a pilot. Okay. So my dad sent me to flying school. I actually came down to Victoria to do some flight training. I learned how to fly a Cessna 150 at like 15.
Wow. Was your dad a pilot?
No.
Okay.
He just was supportive of my wild dreams. That sounds amazing. So I was a bit of a dreamer and I still am. And he just said yes to things, which he really encouraged me to just like not have limits. And I love that and appreciate him. And then I decided when I was 18 that a pilot career probably doesn't like allow you to have like a family, and that was really important to me to kind of be there and like be present as like as a mum that's sort of going to be on the ground. So I sort of pivoted a little bit and was like, oh, what could I do that would, you know, kind of provide a nice life for my family, like one day when I have one. And then I decided to go to uni. I tried something which didn't quite fit. I wanted to sort of like try to get into radiography. Okay. And then I started a science degree, didn't enjoy it. I was in Sydney. I had moved to Sydney away from Canberra.
And you've always been Canberra-based?
Yeah. And so I started uni in Sydney, made a decision to change degrees, and then I was on a path to do commerce. I was really good at it. I was smashing out uni. I had a part-time job. I was having a great time. So uni was great. And then I got a grad role back in Canberra. So I had applied for some vacation placements, got a job, ticked all the boxes, so to speak. And I was, you know, I think like when you're in your 20s, that's your definition of success. And, you know, I sort of was on the path that was projected out for me in those firms, which was do post-grad study, climb the ladder, did all those things. Like I had two kids, still didn't feel that fulfillment that you're supposed to feel when you're like, oh, I've made it. Like, you know, I had like, I was just, I don't feel like I was like enjoying it, and it was actually really hard as well. Like it was a really stressful job at times, high pressure environment sometimes, and yeah, just balancing it with two young babies was not easy. But then I started to do some design work on my new build project,
and because you were building your own home, weren't you?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So it was actually during like the first or second COVID lockdowns that we started our build. So there was like a whole month of tools down in construction at the time, and that's when we demoed our house. So it was very sort of like unknown time for everybody in that industry, and we did our new build, and it was so much fun. Like I had, that was my happy place in a time where everyone was so like uncertain and feeling nervous and feeling anxious. I would just go to the building site and I was like, I'm so happy.
Did you change careers in COVID? Is that what you were
after?
You wanted, like, that was a major change.
It was a huge shift during that building period where I was actually on maternity leave. So I wasn't at work and experiencing that, how do we run our teams, you know, remotely. It did affect me when I went back to work and I had to operate in this new normal a little bit. I don't know, I went back to work part-time, had my kids on my
So console. You had young kids at the time.
Yeah. And I actually just made, you know, I took permission to work 3 days a week, have my kids for 1 day a week with me, and then 1 day was dedicated to my dream.
When you say
creating the dream.
When you say you took permission, was that permission from yourself?
Oh, I just think, you know, I think when, yeah, it is.
Because there's a really interesting choice of words there.
Yeah, taking permission
from your.
Stop reading my notes. So.
Yeah, so taking permission to, like, do something for myself.
Yeah, so when you're a child, you're probably a little bit more risk adverse.
Yeah, I think so.
Then you've gone into a job that is about managing risk and being risk adverse.
Yes.
And then you decide to make a jump and do the complete opposite and start your own interior design business, which is Madison Interiors.
Yes.
That is completely opposite thing. That is high risk. How does that set? How do you change that?
I think I really needed to rewire my brain. When I made that career change, it was about challenging my absolute core beliefs around risk and money and happiness at work and all those things. So I kind of unpacked that a little bit through some personal development work. But definitely I've learned to actually understand how to use your mindset in order to sort of execute some big visions and transformations. So now I kind of have that skill. Like I know if I want to make a big change or I want to go for a big goal of mine, how to frame your mind and tap into that source of power that you have within you to be able to get there. Most people don't, have never really sort of practiced those skills, learned some skills, read books or learned about those kind of skills. I would call them skills, but it is a little bit woo-woo, so I would call it manifestation. So
I would love to know how you got there. Do you think it came from experience? Do you think it came from the time in your life? Or do you think it came from, I mean, I don't know how old you are, and I won't ask. Do you think it came from you thinking, you know what, we have got such a finite time on this planet that, fuck it, I'm going to go and do something that I like? Did you go and do courses? Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. I definitely knew that. I think even when I had changed my mind about my pilot's career, that I was like, even if I do this kind of business career, it may not be the only thing I ever do. Like, it's almost like I knew that I was going to have a career change. Like, when I was 18, I'm like, oh, I'll do this for a little while, see how I go. Who knows where life goes. So I've always had probably a more flexible view of how a career spans in your life. So I wasn't sort of rigid that I would be a consultant or accountant forever. Kind of my mindset at the start of my career. But I think when I was on that maternity leave, I came across a course, read lots of books around manifesting. So I learned basically, you know, 6 or 7 step course process or formula to manifest something big in your life.
Can you talk us through some of those steps?
I'd
love to know.
Yeah, go for it.
Yeah.
All right. So step one.
I love this. All right.
Step one is about being really clear on, like, your vision. So that's, like, what's your desire?
Write this down, man.
Getting clear on your desires. So I do, like, a daily manifestation meditation to just, like, it asks the same questions, but the answers in your brain are always different, right? But once you do that every day, first thing in the morning, like, you get really crystal clear on, like, what the desires are. And some of them are short-term, but some of them are really big. So I think doing that first thing in the morning is now an absolute, like, non-negotiable. It's what I do when I wake up. So, and just writing it down, like brainstorming and brain dumping, like every morning, that's what I do.
Yeah.
And that creates like a vibration around how excited you are for that thing to happen. So the next step is you'll always come across like limiting beliefs. So whatever is going through your head that's challenging you to go, not sure you're quite there yet, or, oh, you're not good enough to do that. It's like you need to actually write down those limiting beliefs and, like, delete them. So,
like, physically, like, cross them
out. Oh, no, it's not about deleting them, like, on the page. There's actually a lot of you could do physical stuff with that. But some people have really core limiting beliefs around, you know, that they're not good enough to do this, you're not smart enough to do this, one of the limiting beliefs that I had was you need to have interior design qualifications before you start your business. And I was like, well, I want to start it now. And I decided, well, I've got a few qualifications and I'm ready and I'm going to start my business. And I studied at the same time. And I actually studied and finished in my first year of running my business.
Wow. So you're a qualified interior designer.
Yeah.
As well, yeah.
But what you do have is all of this past experience, all this life experience,
Yeah, and I did a course to learn how to do all the documentation and modelling, and then I went into my interior design certification, and I feel like that for me was my logical flow to do my, you know, to do my work in my business, and I had a great, you know, I had foundational business skills from a previous career for 12 years. So I was confident and I was super happy that I finished the design course as well. But that was one of the core beliefs that I had to unpack and break down, because there's no rules. So, you know, if I want to start a business, I can. So that was one of the core beliefs that I unpacked. Another one was, you know, the safety that you have around money as a, you know, a qualified, so a consultant. So I was making good money in consulting. I was moving into uncertain territory around how much money I would make. And like, I kind of had to unpack some limiting beliefs around my self-worth being attached to how much money I made. Yeah. So I was, and I'm like super proud to be a designer and I'm making great money, but I wasn't always in my first year. And so having that mindset around, well, I am successful based on a whole bunch of factors and metrics, and one of them is financial, but also like my happiness and how much time and flexibility I have with my kids, and how much personal growth I have because of being able to feed my desire for new skills and learning and networking with people who are like-minded. So
what I love about this is that it's like the same story that you hear from so many people who have changed career, taken the jump to do something that they've always wanted to do. I'm not saying that your story is not unique, but it is unique in its own way. But like, I know for me too, like the evolution of me personally from, you know, manager at Kmart to being in retail for so long to university to, you know what, I want to be a carpenter then a builder. Yeah. And now, like you, like I want to educate, I want to help people. And kind of using my business as a vehicle to be able to do that.
Yeah, I think that's so great. I have
like, we have no right to sit here doing
a podcast. You've got to take, and this is, it goes back to, it's risk. It goes back to the whole risk conversation.
Which you find ironic.
Yes.
And so I'm like, I've flipped risk on its head and So your second step was limiting beliefs. The third and...
So can I, this is where I want to stop you for a second. Yeah. Because at the start you said you're worried about what people would think of you.
Mm.
What do you think people thought of you?
I think they thought that I was crazy.
Like, what do they think? What do you think they think of you now? Are you still crazy?
No, I think they think that I'm happy and I'm bold and I'm brave. I don't know, but I feel like people do feel like, wow, you're so brave to have, like, you know, like you're an extraordinary kind of person that not everybody has that ability. But I feel like everybody has the ability. They just haven't learned how to tap into it.
So my follow-on question quickly is, and what do you think of you now, of yourself?
I'm proud. I'm happy. Cool. Yeah.
That's awesome. That's what I wanted to get at.
I don't think I'm super normal or extraordinary. I think I'm a normal person. Like,
do you know what's interesting from where we're sitting now is that we only know each other from social media. I only know you as a designer, right? And now I'm actually learning about the person of you.
Yeah.
Like, you know, who you used to be, or not even who you used to be, but the different things that you did,
the context around where
around where you are now. So I see you as an interior designer.
Yeah,
and well, up until right now,
you didn't know that story.
I didn't know the story. So I guess what I'm trying to get at is, if you want something, you put yourself out to the world as that thing. People will then relate you to that thing.
Yeah,
and then your story is your story. Your journey is your journey.
Yeah, you have to be brave enough to, like, chase whatever that goal is or that dream or, you know, whether it's a change in your career or if it's, you know, a big project that you're trying to sort of execute. If you're kind of clear on, if you're clear on who, what, you know, how that kind of, the how is actually not that important, but like the specifics, why. You know, and the why, and tapping into the emotions around the why is really important. So, I think I don't flip around on a lot of things that I want. I'm really crystal clear. If I'm going into, you know, chasing my next big goal, because I listen to my intuition and my thoughts every day around that, it becomes crystal clear. I think maybe it's because I actually make time to dream. So I make time every morning before I have like a bit of a morning routine. And I know that like there's a, you know, pros and cons and people kind of have their opinions about morning routines. Mine's not super strict. It's just that I will wake up and I have a coffee because coffee wakes me up and makes me feel good. And I will sit there and I'll just manifest what I'm what my big goals and my dreams are. And I just write like big clouds of mind maps.
And that's super every day. Is that every day?
Yeah.
You're so motivated.
And I just list out any limiting beliefs and I write affirmations. So I think the third step in kind of what I was talking about before was a higher vibration, so tapping into emotions around your big goals. Because I think what motivates me every day to kind of get up and be in my business and to be a great designer but also kind of chase my own personal big dreams and goals is I know what they are and I've written down and I know the feelings around how, you know, what that means to me. And so I'm chasing that feeling. I'm not chasing the goal, if that makes sense, because I'm, imagine what that would feel like when I, you know, land that project or, you know, execute on that vision or, you know, and I've got lots of them, but I won't go into
what are you chasing now? What's the biggest thing you're chasing? Because I feel like interior designs are very endless. You kind of have control of what might go into the project, but if it's not your own house,
yeah,
you probably got to learn to like, I don't like that. The client likes it, but that's what they want. And
yeah.
But that's just understanding your client though.
Yeah.
That's just really getting to know your client, which I'm sure you have a process that you follow. It sounds like you're a very systemized and process-driven person. You learn who your clients are and you work out what their needs are and then you give them, put something in front of them that you think best relates to that brief.
Yeah. As my business is starting to establish more and more, we do service like different styles and it's really the client brief is the style of the house that we will design for our clients, the interiors. I think what's starting to develop is as you evolve as a designer, you are obviously honing your own kind of aesthetic. I don't specifically attract clients in only one domain or one aesthetic, but I do find myself creating more of a brand around a few different styles, but they're mainly those styles gravitate towards organic, natural finishes, connected to nature is kind of the aesthetic. It's not so much like I think the styles that I'm developing more of an affinity for would be coastal, Mediterranean, modern kind of Australian country style houses as well. We are getting a lot of regional projects which are, they're modern, but they are in a regional setting. So you want to relate them to the Australian bush that's around you and kind of bring some of those, the connection to nature into the interiors. So I love the projects that we're working on that are sort of country-based, but definitely we've got city, coastal and regional projects and we only do Japandi or we only do coastal or we only do a certain thing. I think people do gravitate towards the mood boards and the products that we're showing in our portfolio as finished use cases.
Looking at what you've done on social media, like I look at what you do and I'm like, I feel it's very timeless.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you talk about coastal, you talk about country, you talk about connection to nature. Like you can't...
That's in itself is timeless.
Is timeless. And I feel that's reflective in some of the mood boards that I've seen on absolutely. Social media. Yeah.
We're definitely... We get that brief a lot and I think that's just naturally like where I go. I think like as a mum and also as someone who's built my own house, I do want it to have that longevity and I do want it to feel timeless, but I also want it to feel personal. And so we will listen to the client's brief around what colours they like because that will be what's timeless to them, if that makes sense. So what's timeless to me is different to what's timeless to my client. I think some clients can live with, you know, pops of colour and that's amazing and timeless for them. And other people will be like, well, we want a little bit more of a restrained palette because that's what's timeless for them. So definitely translating what is timeless is part of our briefing process.
So how about trends then? Because we're at the Archibald Expo right now and a lot of the stuff here is about trends.
Trends are an important part of, you know, I guess the interior design industry. I think they have their place in inspiring, definitely inspiring, creating food for thought. And definitely I think trends have a place where if you are trying to establish something as, you know, a little bit more bespoke and people are connected to that, I think the main thing is that if that trend connects with your client, like if your client comes in and they're like, we love all the rich timbers and the browns, and we're really loving this trend, then you know straight away that that's not, like, you know, going to be a deal breaker for them in the long term. I think I would never sort of pick a trend because it's trendy and incorporate it into a design without there being some connection to the brief and, you know. And I probably don't jump onto trends as much as...
The block trendy.
Yeah,
sorry,
certainly not trying to set any trends, if that makes sense. Like, I'm not pioneering in the trend space, but I definitely timeless personal homes.
Super, what's like your go-to? Like, what's a product or something that you just like? I like getting that in every home. It might be like lime-based paints.
Every product is unique, but I definitely feel like at the moment, like, for example, flooring. Engineered timber is probably like a go-to at the moment in terms of like, you know, a certain level of finish for a house. We've come across some really great, you know, products which do tick a lot of boxes.
It's cost effective,
you know, we can tick some of the durability requirements of families with that product. And I guess it's, it's a beautiful product. It's got that natural finish in it. Another one that I'm really, I think, drawn to, just because it's got that timeless natural finish, is a quartzite as a natural stone. So if people are looking for a natural stone, all the quartzites, or it's a category of natural stone, but quartzite has the durability and the kind of heat resistance from a natural stone product.
So like a granite?
So granite's a different kind of category. It's super durable as well. So it's like high in that kind of durability space. But yeah, like, I think some natural stones are softer, scratch and chip easier,
like marble.
And so when people go, okay, I'm a little bit scared of using natural stone, you've kind of got to educate them to go, okay, well, if we use a quartzite, we can actually alleviate some of your concerns. We do get a lot of families that maybe don't want to use natural stone, and there's also a raft of products out there that we can sort of show them, porcelain products, tinted stone, which has, you know, it does have that kind of stain repellence in the properties. So, yeah, we definitely listen to the client's needs and concerns around maintenance and things like that, and give them, you know, obviously give them the best product for their requirements.
What do you think the biggest misconception around interior designers is?
Oh, it depends. It depends who you ask, I guess. But the role of an interior designer, I think, can sometimes... Some people who have never worked with an interior designer might have an idea that it's maybe to do with furniture, and there's not an understanding of what interior designers do, for example, on the hard finishes side. So there's two parts to my business, essentially. There's the interior design, you know, we're developing the interior architecture selections and all the joinery for a new build or a renovation, and I would call that a hard finishes job.
And that includes all the CAD drawings, all that sort of stuff,
And that is super technical. It's, you know, you need to know the products, you need to know how they perform. There's a lot of advisory around the products that you're actually putting into the design specifications, and limitations that you need to put on all of the notes and paperwork. There's, you know, you need to know building standards and understand how, you know, you need to comply with them. So, yeah, it's definitely, that is, you know, a very technical part of the job. We also have an additional service that we provide, which is our furniture and styling service, and that's to curate furniture and
interior decorating.
Essentially. So we always try and sort of add that into our projects as, you know, an additional service, but our core business, I would say, is the interior design around, you know, new builds and renovations.
This is where I kind of wanted to get to, and I think that, I know we've had this conversation before, I personally feel interior designers are undervalued, and I think there's an issue with the conception that an interior designer will just pick a few colours, pick your tiles, and that's it.
We're not like a selection centre. No. It's not,
And I think that it starts with, you've made two really good points. One, I think to call yourself an interior designer, you need to be able to draw CAD drawings and CAD drawings, and two is know the standards.
Yes.
I think you shouldn't be going around calling yourself an interior designer just because you pick some floorboards. And I'm going to be really hard on that with people, because I think it discredits a lot then of what you guys do.
Yeah, exactly.
There's so much to it about creating a space that is inviting for everyone.
Yeah,
and absolutely. Even some of your language around understanding how light comes into the building as well. I know it was some of your notes that we got before this podcast. Not everyone thinks about that. I mean, we think about it because we build high performance and passive house. That's really important for that solar gain. But, you know, that plays a huge role in interior design, how each room feels.
Yeah, so we just, like, we will design according to the orientation. Yep. Like, we take into account how small. So, like, when I first start a job, I will study the floor plans, make lots of notes. I look at, like, the orientation of, you know, certain rooms. Just make sure that we're not sort of making rooms too dark or too, you know, like, if there is a dark room already, we need to probably use some reflective finishes.
Do you work with like a lighting consultant as well?
Yeah, so we do a lighting plan as part of our lighting work that we do. So I'll select lights, pendant lights, the feature lights for the whole house, and we'll do a lighting plan. But we also look at the architectural lighting. So looking at, you know, where you might have artwork, where you might have, you know, cathedral style or raked ceilings, where we want to bounce the light upwards instead of all down lights, because, you know, the angles are something to celebrate. So I think definitely there's a lot of technical work, and, you know, it's not only selections. There's a lot of detailed planning behind how to use the selections, if that makes sense. So we do have, when I work with clients, we have three tiers of service, and I think it's kind of nice to kind of put it into perspective that our base service is a selections only package. So we do a whole new build. We can do all the kind of, you know, colours, lighting, doors, tapware, everything that's for that project is specified as a selection in the schedule. Then we have a mid-tier package, and then a kind of full service. And the mid-tier package is some mood boards and some conceptual imagery, as well as all the selections. And then our full tier package, which most people who are doing a dream home will sort of get into that full service. And that's building from concepts into a set of detailed drawings.
I reckon every client, if you're listening, I personally as a builder won't jump into a project that an interior designer hasn't been a part of.
Yeah.
I think it's really, really important. It honestly, I think the cost you put into an interior designer, Haim, I think that if they're not going to do it, they've got to pay someone along the way to do it, and then it becomes us as builders. And don't listen to us.
Or the client's choosing. 100%.
Yeah,
and that can be a disaster.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden there's grey areas within contracts and expectations, and just pay, like, the time that you're going to save is crazy. I know Nicole and I going through our house, there are so much conversations where, like,
there's many decisions. I feel
endless.
So, you know, when I do an interior design project, we estimate the amount of hours that we kind of dedicate to, like, a full service design. It's sort of over, you know, 200 hours for a full new build. And if you don't have that extra 200 hours in the space of, like, you know, the planning phase of your build, I'm doing that.
But you know what you're looking for, though.
I'm doing it during the day. I'm doing it as part of my job. I'm fully engaged in those decisions. And if clients or if people aren't using a designer, they're making those decisions in the wee hours of the evening once their kids are asleep. They're making quick decisions. They're then second-guessing those decisions.
And they don't know where to look. At least you know where to look.
Yeah.
Or it's going into the provisional sum and it's getting made on the fly.
Yep.
And then things are disjointed. So it's probably just circles back to a question I wanted to ask before. At what point are you getting involved in a set of documents?
Yeah, so the ideal time for us to sort of, for an interior designer to start having a conversation around working with a client is in that kind of floor plan stage, and it's usually when the floor plan's more progressed. So it's in that sort of final revision, or if you've locked it in, you know, you've got a full detailed sort of like working drawings which are then going and getting approved. While it's in the approval stage, we generally love to get, you know, involved through either the architect or the builder. A lot of our work comes through, you know, word of mouth and through relationships that we have. But equally, if we haven't had that relationship with anybody, the time that, if you're listening now and you want to work with an interior designer, the time to engage is as early as possible, but definitely
at the beginning.
I was going to say, we bang on about it.
Before anything's drawn.
Yeah, and we'd love to be involved as early as possible, but that's probably ideal or the latest. Like, we don't want to sort of be in construction and then be pulled into the conversation once things have
obviously been. Oh, but why not? That sounds completely logical.
And that's only because then, so you know, you don't have the timeline of getting into the bookings at the right time.
So you and I both work with an interior designer, and the same one. So we work with Erin from Hey Hey often, and I don't know how many projects we've been on where Erin's come in and she's seen a floor plan and she's like, why is it like that? And we've actually gone back before we've gone to site, before permits are being issued, and actually got the drawings updated because the client didn't feel heard or they were missed.
Or not challenged.
Or not challenged.
Okay, yeah.
And had we've completely redone floor plans.
Yep.
Because
just to account for the interiors.
And on reflection and having seen these homes now built and seeing how they're being used, and I think about some of the early iterations of the plans which didn't have the floor plan as it's built now, and I'm like, I don't know how the clients would have done X, Y, and Z if the interior designer wasn't in. And imagine...
And we love to do a floor plan review.
Yes.
If there is anything that we might be able to change... and keep still within the building regulations. But there's definitely, I think, particularly where there's joinery involved, you'd love your joinery to sort of be inbuilt rather than to be extruded and to be sort of like hanging out. So I think those kind of settings or within an architectural plan, definitely we love to be able to go, okay, well, could we tweak this? I will always try and circle back around with the architect during that time if a client does want to change anything.
Yeah, because, you can run it by them first.
Yeah, I think also like there's also decisions why things have been done in a certain way, and if you do change it, like they need to be a part of that process and engaged.
I know we bang on about it time and time again, and building's probably never been more expensive than it is now with so many projects not going ahead due to budget reasons. But if you want to give your project the best chance to succeed in getting to site, get your builder, your building designer or architect, your interior designer, your consultants around energy and performance,
landscape designer,
get them all involved early on from the start. Get your dream team together and that is giving you the best chance and probably I'd say nearly the only chance for your project to succeed.
Well, yeah, I mean, you think about interiors. I mean, interiors are a big ticket item as a big chunk of cash in a project. So it has to be considered the big
ticket. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. There's usually two ways a project will evolve. Sometimes we will have the contract in place and that way we have a set of parameters around budget which inform the brief as part of our brief. And sometimes it'll be the other way around. We will be doing the interiors, which will then be fed into the building contract being priced. There's no right or wrong way in terms of how to engage with an interior designer, but I think having clear conversations around budget are really important at the outset of the design process, and also just understanding what's important in terms of value and spend versus save decisions in a project. Like what someone wants to pay is really important to them. Like, so if I was to do a project, I know where I might want to spend and where I might want to save, and that's different in every project and what means.
Good point.
And what value is to one person is different to another person. Yep. And we can still actually, I think like most projects, there's always a balance. You can't sort of just like go high spec on everything and know and feel like that's going to actually be implemented.
Unless you have a money tree.
No. And like none of my projects have ever been like that. There's always been some conversation around what we're spending and what we're saving on. But I would say that joinery is the biggest cost in the interior design. Yeah. And joinery is one of those things that, you know, is subjective in terms of we don't know exactly where it's going to land, but we need to know, okay, well, we work in sort of price tiers. So, you know, whether we're using, a cheaper finish for the benchtop or we're using a premium finish or we're using a mid-range finish, we have that kind of indication of price at every point. Yeah. And we will... explain that to our clients, as well as, you know, the types of door finishes that you're using and make sure that they know that they're in, whether they're in like a low, mid or high tier for the doors and the stone. And
but you can even play around with that. You could do, all right, you know what? I just want my kitchen to be the showstopper.
Yeah.
I couldn't give a shit about the bathroom.
Exactly. And yeah. so you can spend and save in different yeah. areas and yeah. just tweak those a little bit. Yeah.
So I want to finish up, and you're a mum and you're someone who's managed risk your whole career, potentially worried about potentially worried about what others might think. And if your kids were to listen to this in, say, 20 years and the journey you've been on, what do you want them to take away from this?
I definitely care less what other people think, right? At this point in my career, I think I've probably evolved since then to probably prioritise what my own happiness and how I feel about my own set of values. What was the question, sorry?
If you want your kids to listen to this in 20 years, what would you want them to take away from this conversation?
If you want to be a pilot,
I say this now and I'll say it in 20 years to my kids that they should just do what makes them happy yeah. and go for their dreams. And if they're going to do something, give it your best shot. And yeah. I guess there's no linear path in life and you will continue to evolve and that's not a failure. I think that, you know, people who have professional athletes' careers have to evolve after yeah. their athletic career. Everyone has the same opportunity to sort of evolve in their careers and in life and in general.
Or change careers.
Change their mind, you know, if they're not, if something's not working for them anymore, like, that's okay. And define their own version of success.
Can I just round something out now? Because you were worried about failure.
Yeah.
Now, would the message not be to your kids, don't be afraid of failure?
Yeah, I guess, yeah. Don't be afraid of failure. I guess like failure is kind of one of those things that's...
Failure's okay.
Yeah. It's what you do with a setback. I probably don't love the word failure, but if you've had a setback or if you define something as a failure, you can either take it two ways. You can look at it and dwell on it and feel negative about the failure, or you could look at something and go, hey, okay, well, that didn't work out. I have a very firm belief that everything is meant to happen just the way it happened, or everything is as it should be. So if you hit something or if you had a failure, it was meant to be there in your way to teach you something, to learn something, to grow and move on. And thank you for that lesson, universe.
If we want to get onto you or someone yes. needs to look for interior design advice, how do we contact you?
Instagram is the new business.
Just slip into the DMs.
I think. Honestly, I do a lot of chatting and lead generation yeah. through the DMs because yeah. like we've got lots of followers. Yeah. But, you know, my website and social media is probably where you will see some of my work. You'll hear the messaging around our brand and get to know myself and the brand a little bit more. You can read about it on the website, but then every message on our social media links back to kind of the values that we hold as business. And to contact us, you follow the contact page on the website. Yeah. You can also book a discovery call from our Instagram links.
Perfect. Thank you.
Or shoot us a DM.
Thank you for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for sharing.
Yeah. Appreciate it.